Hello, and welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Rosemarie Onkwe, bringing you readings from the following publications: The Beacon, Kansas City, Blavity, The Root, The Griot, News One, Anscape, and The Voice. Today we'll begin our readings from an article titled Victoria Mboku, M-B-O-K-O, Has a New Star Been Born? By Bonita Gooch, The Voice, August 4th, 2025. It appears Canadian teenager Victoria Mboku has arrived in a fashion very similar to the arrival of the star she upset, Coco Gauff, who is currently the number 2 rated women's tennis player in the world. People may remember Gauff's official recognition as a future star when at age 14 she beat Venus Williams at the Wimbledon Grand Slam. Now at age 21, Gauff felt the burn when she was upset yesterday by 18-year-old Mboku, 6-1 to 6-4. Needless to say, Gauff hasn't been playing very well since she won the French Open earlier this summer, and her performance was less than impressive. However, fans are questioning whether Gauff just had an off day, or is Mboku just that good? The 18-year-old Mboku, ranked 85th in the world, finished off the 21-year-old Gauff, who had 24 unforced errors in 1 hour, 2 minutes. Who is Victoria Mboku? Mboku is a Canadian player whose parents emigrated from the Democratic Republic of Congo in the late 1990s to escape political turmoil. They first settled in the U.S. before relocating to Canada in 2006. She has 3 older tennis-playing siblings, Gracia, Kevin, and David, 2 of whom competed at the collegiate level. Inspired from age 3 or 4, Mboku began chasing tennis balls fed by her dad at local courts. Her siblings helped guide and motivate her as she developed her game. Her father worked night shifts early in her career to ensure he could drive her to all her practices and matches, making sacrifices that she deeply values. Her coaches describe her as humble, mature beyond her years, and deeply grounded in family values and support. Mboku began the year ranked around number 333, then stormed to win in 22 straight matches on the lower-level International Tennis Federation circuit, with only 1 loss by early March. She posted a 27-1 record before moving on to the higher level Women's Tennis Association League. She broke into the WTA Top 100 following her Grand Slam debut at the French Open, where she made it to the third round. Her win against Gauff in Montreal gives her a live ranking of 53, and she could be even higher with the potential of 3 more rounds she could win in Canada. Her rapid ascent marks her as one of the sport's most exciting rising stars. She's playing high-level tennis, Gauff said in a post-match interview with the press. I think that's what showed today. I think she was the better player. However, she was quick to shoot down comparisons between herself and Mboku. No, I've never been one to compare myself to others, she snapped back. Whether it be people comparing me to Serena or Venus, and I don't think it's fair to put that on her as well. She's a completely different player, completely different person. She did, however, laud the talent of the 18-year-old, adding, I do see someone who's going to have a really bright future for sure. She's very athletic. She's a great ball striker, and she seems pretty positive out there on the court. Doesn't get really too negative. While Gauff responded to the journalist maturely, her fans online didn't find the question respectful, saying it sounded racially motivated and based solely on skin color. One fan bluntly suggests Goff should have hushed them instead by saying, "Would you say this if she weren't black?" An ex-user wished to know whether Mira Andreeva, another rising tennis star who's white, also faces the same in her interviews. Disgusting question. Do you ask Mira if she sees herself in Sharapova, a white female tennis standout who shocked the world by winning Wimbledon as a teenager in 2004 at age 17? This article was titled, "Victoria Mboku, Has a New Star Been Born?" written by Bonita Gooch, The Voice, August 4th, 2025. Next, an article from The Beacon, Kansas City, titled, "Lee's Summit Schools Serve Growing Number of English Language Learners," by Maria Benevento, August 5th, 2025. It might be easy to miss, but the Lee's Summit R7 school district is changing. English Language Development Coordinator Melissa Otero is in her sixth year with the district. In that time, she's seen the number of English language learners, ELL students, increase dramatically. During the 2020-21 school year, the number of ELL students hit a record low of 222, according to state records. By 2023-24 school year, the latest state data available, that number had nearly doubled. Otero said that it's even higher now as the district prepares to enter the school year with about 550 active ELL students. Another 184 who recently learned English are being monitored. That's only about 3% of the district's most recently reported enrollment, but it represents one of the ways Lee's Summit has become more diverse, requiring it to adjust to meet the needs of its current students. Last year, the district introduced a phone interpretation service called Propio, P-R-O-P-I-O. Events such as family culture nights attempt to build inclusivity, and a 2-week welcome center in the district's central office is open to all, but specifically geared toward immigrant families. Otero said the number of teachers for English language learners has roughly doubled since she joined the district to 17. She'd like to see even more staff. She also wants the school district and broader community to understand how rapidly the ELL growth is happening and how to support and include students. It's challenging, just because I feel like we are the unseen population in the district, she said. If you look at numbers, it's obvious that our department has grown. But Lee's Summit is still slow to grow in accepting the fact that there's a huge change in diversity in our population here. Who are the ELL students? There's diversity among ELL students as well. Slightly more than half speak Spanish, 9% Arabic, 5% Urdu, and 5% Vietnamese, Otero said. Jermaine Wilson, Assistant Superintendent of Equity and Student Services, also named Pashto, Russian, Korean, Popanian, Mandarin, Haitian Creole, Turkish, and French as among the district's languages. Otero said many of the families have fled hardships in their home countries. Most are refugees or asylum seekers. Refugees have permission to move to the United States because of persecution in their homelands. Asylum seekers arrive in the U.S. and go through a legal process seeking to stay because of persecution in their home country. Our department has really worked on being welcoming to our families, Otero said. They feel safe here. ELL students make up a small percentage of the district, but that percentage is increasing. In 2009, the earliest state data available ELL students were less than 1% of the district's enrollment. By 2023-24, the percentage had tripled to about 2.5%. The 550 students Otero counted for this coming year would be more than 3% of the district's most recently reported enrollment. The increased ELL enrollments comes as the district has become more diverse overall. Lee Summit schools were more than 95% white in 1991, the earliest data available from the state. Enrollment is now less than two-thirds white. The percentage of white students went from more than 96% in 1991 to about 65% in 2024. The percentage of students receiving free and reduced-priced lunch, often used as a proxy for the number of low-income students in a district, has also significantly increased. Otero said it might take time for the district to register that it's also becoming more diverse linguistically. When people think of diversity, they think of skin color, or they think of socioeconomic status, and that's not the only thing that's diverse, she said. Cultural and linguistic diversity is important. Providing support. On a Thursday in July, Otero and two English language teachers were stationed in the district's central office to help families enroll. Snacks and school supplies were lined up on tables. The event, known as the Welcome Center, was especially intended to help non-English speaking families with school enrollment. Otero said the event drew 8 families the first year it started, but had far exceeded that number less than halfway through its 2-week span this year. The fact that we've still helped 140 students enroll, with what's going on politically, just lets us know we're doing our job, helping them feel safe, she said. Our teachers work really hard to not just teach their students English, but to also build those relationships. English language development teachers are trained to teach students English, even if they don't share a language in common, Otero said. About half of the English language teachers in Lee's Summit are bilingual, which is helpful in communicating with some families. The teachers go above and beyond to help with needs outside the classroom as well, Otero said, such as making sure families have food, school supplies, or reminders to sign paperwork. It could even mean accompanying a teen to an ultrasound appointment. Otero said the teachers take care of families so well that it helps the program fly under the radar. We're not the squeaky wheel, she said. But she tries to be loud in advocating for more resources, reaching outside the district to groups such as churches for extra support. They donated calculators because we don't have any money right now, she said. Whatever my teachers and my families need, I'm always willing to advocate for them. Awareness and support outside of the department are growing too. ELL students used to be bused to centralized sites, Otero said, which gave the impression that regular classroom teachers weren't responsible for them. I wouldn't say there's not acceptance. I think it's just ignorance, Otero said. Our program is kind of invisible because in comparison to other departments, it's significantly smaller. But the amount of growth is 10 times more than any other department. ELL teachers have worked hard to provide professional development and help classroom teachers feel a shared sense of ownership for their students, she said. The district also recently invested in Propio, a phone interpretation service that staff can use to help communicate with families. They can walk into a school and say they have a language need, or if anybody in the front office suspects there is a language need, they can offer the service, Wilson said. We can get somebody on the phone within 5 minutes to help interpret. That helped out a lot, with families feeling welcome in our buildings. While families usually prefer in-person interpretation, Otero said the service helps fill in the gaps when a staff member who speaks the needed language isn't available. That's especially key for languages like Pashto, where it can be hard to find local interpreters. Otero said she'd always like to see more resources, particularly more ELL teachers. And the political climate has made things more difficult as well. Throughout most of July, schools were in limbo over whether the federal government would release funding for migrant education and English language acquisition. Otero has also worried some immigrant families won't come to school. When I have my families not feeling safe, or I have my high school kids dropping out because they don't feel safe, that doesn't resonate well with me, she said. We find ways to graduate these kiddos. They work really, really hard. Ultimately, Otero said, the goal is not just to help students achieve academically. Once they graduate and have a piece of paper that says, you graduated, I want them to have something beyond that, so they can have a good future. They came here for that. This article was titled, Lee Summit Schools Serve Growing Number of English Language Learners, written by Mario Benevento, The Beacon, Kansas City, August 5th, 2025. The next article is titled, 25-year-old opens Don's Laundry in New York City after helping his parents run laundromats, written by Kui Mwai, K-U-I-M-W-A-I, Blavity, August 5th, 2025. Brandon Hollingsworth, Hollingsworth, who is better known by his nickname, Don, grew up watching his parents run laundromats, and at 25 years old, he has decided to open his own laundry venture. According to ABC7, Hollingsworth's Don's Laundry opened on December 31st in New York City's Queens Borough, and his parents are beaming with pride. When he was growing up, Brandon not only watched his parents own and operate two full-service laundromats, he also helped his parents run their business. All the mistakes that were made, I was watching firsthand, so I know not to make the same mistakes. I learned to put my money away and not spend on frivolous things. And I actually sold sneakers to get enough money to pay the lawyer to get the store, Brandon told WABC. He left college his sophomore year to pursue his dream of owning his own laundromat. His mother, Nicole Hollingsworth, said he had a meticulous business plan to ensure his success. He had a documented business plan. He knew exactly the steps he needed to take, and he was prepared. I could not be upset with that, Nicole told WABC. Hollingsworth is the oldest of five siblings, and Nicole said the way he treated his siblings hinted at a future entrepreneurial career. I've known Brandon would be a business owner, probably since he was six, and convinced his brothers to swap beds with him and do all the work, she said. The 25-year-old's entrepreneurial spirit is sure to rub off on his siblings, as he told the outlet, other people that look like me. Hollingsworth's father, Randy Hollingsworth, said he's extremely proud of his hard-working son. I'm very proud of him, very proud to the moon and back, Randy told WABC. Brandon often shares his entrepreneurial journey on social media. His Instagram bio also notes that he's a model in New York City. The sky's the limit for the 25-year-old, who is also planning on expanding his business, thanks in part to a few inspiring words from his mother. Reach for the stars, like do it scared, do it no matter what it is, go for it, Nicole said, while recapping the encouragement she has provided to Hollingsworth. Brandon added that he's focused on catering to my customers, making sure they feel welcome and accepted, and they leave always with a smile. This article is titled, 25-year-old opens Don's Laundry in New York City after helping his parents run laundromats, written by Kui Mwawi, Blavity, August 5th, 2025. Next, an article titled, Regina King Launches Wine Brand Mian Yu, M-I-A-N-U, inspired by her late son, Ian Alexander Jr., written by Hanaya Philogene, H-A-N-I-Y-A-H, P-H-I-L-O-G-E-N-E, The Griot, August 5th, 2025. On the fifth day of Black Business Month, the award-winning actress released Mian Yu, a vibrant orange wine crafted to complement everything from casual gatherings to special celebrations in honor of her late son, Ian Alexander Jr. It was Ian who first introduced me to orange wine, King wrote on Instagram. Its playful and complex flavors capture his taste and talent for transforming everyday moments into something exceptional. Inspired by Ian's deep love for art, flavor, and the people around him, I created a wine that celebrates the beauty of connection. King lost her only son to suicide in January 2022, just days after his 26th birthday. Alexander Jr. was her first and only son, whom she shared with ex-husband, music producer, Ian Alexander Sr. When I look at all the work and everything that we and Ian put into trying to move through the depression, I mean, he's pure joy and pure light, King said of her son in a 2024 Harper's Bazaar interview. But he was struggling so much. One of the things I've learned on this journey is that gratitude and sadness are not mutually exclusive. They're always working at the same time. Now, 3 years later, she's celebrating her son's legacy through Mianu Wines. I want to celebrate how he makes me feel, King explained in a video. That's the birth of this wine. It's a celebration of Ian and all of the things that you can't explain because it's something that you feel. My son helped me to embrace imperfections, finding beauty in the bruises. Me and You, which sounds like Me and You, is an intentional play on the words that honors her son and celebrates the brand's belief that every moment can be extraordinary when shared with the right people and the right wine. Me and You isn't just about wine. It's about crafting experiences that remind us of the importance of community, creativity, and joy. It's a wine born out of love, driven by Ian's passion for living life fully, and designed to inspire others to do the same, she continued on Instagram. Whether through sharing a bottle of wine, connecting over art, or simply celebrating the special moments with those we care about, Me and You brings people together and honors Ian's lasting impact. Made from white grapes, fermented on their skins, the orange wine is rooted in centuries-old winemaking traditions from the Republic of Georgia. Described as 75% Gewürztraminer, a German wine, 25% Chardonnay, Mian Yu is described to pair well with fresh seafood, seasonal vegetables, hard cheeses, and bolder spiced dishes. Shoppers can feel the magic of Mian Yu for $34 on mianuwines.com. This article was titled, Regina King Launches Wine Brand Mian Yu, Inspired by Her Late Son, Ian Alexander Jr. Written by Hanaya Philogene, The Griot, August 5th, 2025. The next article is titled, Black People Loved Malcolm Jamal Warner Fiercely, and He Loved Us Back. Written by Kelly L. Carter and Scape, July 23rd, 2025. This one hits differently. The sudden, tragic, and horrific loss of our dearly departed Malcolm Jamal Warner hurts like hell. Y'all, 54 is too young. It's around that age when you have finally and confidently settled into the human you're supposed to be and your voice is most amplified. It's the time of life when you know so much because you've lived it, and you're ready, really ready, to finish becoming who you're supposed to become. But no, it's bigger than that, and losing him hits differently because of it. Warner was our brother, our cousin. He was our homie and one of the first to change the narrative. Sure, that was a microaggression rooted in the racist structure of the society we were growing up in. But for me, it gave me relief, because I'd gotten tired pretty early in my life of trying to battle the "you talk white, were you adopted by white people" questions. In The Cosby Show, we finally had a college-educated black nuclear family that didn't need to move on up to the right side of town because they were already there. And being successful didn't compromise their blackness or, and here's the gotcha, make them shy away from it either. Their home was filled with Afrocentric artwork, the music they celebrated was black, and the colleges they championed, both fictional and real ones, were HBCUs, like the one my dad graduated from. And it wasn't just people who looked like me who watched the show. Everyone watched. For 5 seasons, The Cosby Show consistently topped rating charts, and it became one of the most popular and influential television sitcoms of all time. Malcolm Jamal Warner was well aware of the significance of the show at a young age, something he shared with me in our last interview in 2021. At the time, we were talking about his role on the TV series The Resident, where he portrayed a surgeon who was triple board certified in cardiothoracic, general, and trauma surgery. It seemed to me back then that Warner's choices were intentional, that he'd built a post-Cosby career, primarily focusing on roles where he brought high-achieving black men to life. I've just always been very intent on not doing work that is not going to perpetuate negative stereotypes of who we are. But I also don't work as much as I could, he said. That wasn't the first time we'd had a similar conversation. Years ago, he and Tracy Ellis Ross produced and starred in a series for BET called Read Between the Lines, R-E-E-D, which very much felt like a send-up to the Huxtables. The show featured a blended family headed by 2 highly educated professionals who worked through conflict resolution in a way that we don't often see black families navigate on screen, mostly because our stories get wired up inside of trauma. In explaining the difference between the Cosbys and the Reeds, Warner shared, "We've all grown up on Cosby, and we've all been educated on the fact, there really is such a thing as a black middle class. But the Reeds are not on the same financial level of the Huxtables. This family is more accessible. The kids are probably a little more hip," he explained, while I visited the set. "I always say, just like the Jeffersons or Good Times could not represent all black people, the Huxtables could not represent all black people either. Here we have a show where we're showing you a different facet of black life, the black community." That was important to Warner, and it was important to the audience around him. He helped gift us this beautiful thing called representation at a time when all of the 80s brown kids desperately needed it. In our last interview, I asked Warner if his willingness to represent for black folks was intentional. He chuckled. "My father named me after Malcolm X and Ahmad Jamal, and it wasn't until I was about 15 that I understood what he did. I recalled saying, 'Wow, dude, you set me up. You can't be named after those 2 men and not be something,'" he explained. "And then my experience on Cosby and being on such a groundbreaking show, that really expanded white America, black America, and really the global view on who we are as black people." In 2021, in the aftermath of George Floyd's murder, we were all having a loud conversation about, despite the progress we'd made in this country, there still was so much more work to do. And from my slice of the world in Hollywood, that shows up in not only the final output that everyday people get to see while sitting in front of their couches on their converted dens, hoping to see themselves reflected on screen. But in order to get there, it has to start with who is behind the camera and who is in the rooms calling the shots long before a camera starts rolling. Malcolm Jamal Warner understood that too. In an uncanny twist of my two childhood faves, Warner's first time directing was New Edition's 1989 video, Northeast Heartbreak. I often jokingly told him that clearly was my most favorite thing he had ever directed, but he didn't stop there. Over the years, Warner stepped behind the camera to direct episodes of The Cosby Show, Nickelodeon's All That on Kenan and Kel, his show with Eddie Griffin, Malcolm and Eddie, and even The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, which surely benefited from the global success The Cosby Show. In 1982, Warner also directed a teen-centered public health video called Time Out, the truth about HIV, AIDS, and you, which featured NBA great Magic Johnson. If that wasn't enough, Warner was an acclaimed poet and musician, winning a Grammy in 2015 alongside Robert Glasper and Layla Hathaway. But in Hollywood, Warner still had more work to do. There still were more portrayals of high-achieving black men in his future, and there was more for him to do behind the camera as well. But above all, he was looking for balance. I took a step back from directing, because I got to a point where between the acting and directing, because my morals, my sensibilities, and my social consciousness are the same in the acting lane and the directing lane, the political battles that I was having, the integrity battles that I was having them in both careers. It was too much, he admitted. If I put all of my eggs in both of these baskets, this industry is going to break my heart. Still, he wanted to get back there. He needed to get back there, and we needed him to get back there. But today, and for a long time after it, so many of us will mourn his loss in unison. We know how big of a gaping hole his passing brings. Malcolm Jamal Warner was a quiet giant who helped deliver the loudest thing Hollywood needed, and now he's no longer with us. This hits differently, because this hurt feels familiar. A beloved member of our family is gone, and the world just doesn't feel right because of it. This article was titled, Black People Loved Malcolm Jamal Warner Fiercely, and He Loved Us Back, written by Kelly L. Carter and Scape, July 23rd, 2025. Next, an article from News One titled, Sanaa Lathan, Sanaa Lathan, A Journey Through the Actress's Career Over the Years, written by Shannon Dawson, August 5th, 2025. Sanaa Lathan is one of Hollywood's most versatile and beloved actresses. From her breakthrough role in Love and Basketball to her amazing performances in films and TV shows, such as the fan-favorite love film, The Best Mom, or the hilarious cartoon, Family Guy, Lathan has built a career that is both inspiring and groundbreaking. She's not just a talented performer. She's an icon who has continuously reinvented herself while breaking down barriers for women of color in the entertainment industry. Let's take a look back at the milestones of Sanaa Lathan's career and her evolution as an artist. Born on September 19, 1971, in New York City, Lathan comes from a family with a rich artistic heritage. Her father, Stan Lathan, was a well-known television director, and her mother, Eleanor McCoy, was a dancer and actress, according to her IMDb profile. Lathan's upbringing was immersed in the arts, and her early exposure to creative expression set the stage for her career in acting. She attended Yale School of Drama, where she earned an MFA, and she also received a bachelor's degree in English from the University of Berkeley, California, honing her craft before moving to Los Angeles to pursue acting, according to Black Past and Geffen Playhouse, G-E-F-F-E-N. Lathan's breakout role came in 2000 with the film Love and Basketball, where she portrayed Monica Wright, a passionate basketball player, trying to balance her athletic dreams while falling in love with her close friend Quincy McCall, played by Omar Epps. The film, which became a cult classic, showcased Lathan's talent for blending vulnerability with strength, qualities that would define her career. During an interview with People in 2024, Lathan reflected on Love and Basketball's popularity, recalling how she received a 5-minute standing ovation after her film debuted at the Sundance Film Festival in 2000. "I was just floored. And the rest is history," she said. "It became this thing where people watched it over and over and over again, and it crossed all racial and cultural lines." The celeb added, "What a gift it was that I was able to, at a young age, play this amazing, fierce character in this beloved movie. When we were making it, for me, I was nervous about the basketball, because I really wasn't a basketball player. I looked like a basketball player because I had a dance background, so I was able to really mimic. But that wasn't the only highlight from the actress's illustrious career. Here are a few more career highs from Lathan's stunning Hollywood resume over the year. The Best Man Boom. The 90s and 2000s were a defining decade for Lathan, as she took on a variety of roles in both film and television. She played the role of Robin in the original The Best Man, 1999. The hilarious comedy followed old college friends as they reunited for a fun and drama-filled wedding. The franchise followed up with a Christmas-themed sequel, The Best Man Holiday, in November 2013, and both films saw major success at the box office. The original grossed $34 million domestically on a $9 million budget. The 2013 follow-up earned $70 million, according to Deadline. She continued to build a career of diverse roles. Lathan would continue to expand her film portfolio with a number of diverse roles throughout the 2000s. In 2001, the New York native starred in The Wood, a coming-of-age film about friendship and love. The film highlighted her ability to portray relatable, complex characters and establish her as a rising star in Hollywood. Lathan also made waves in romantic comedies such as Brown Sugar, 2002, where she starred opposite Taye Diggs as a musical journalist who confronts the intersection of love, friendship, and hip-hop culture. The film was a hit and cemented Lathan's place as one of the go-to actresses for romantic and heartfelt performances. But Lathan was far from confined to one genre. In 2003, she starred in the psychological thriller The Perfect Guy, showcasing her range in more dramatic roles. Her willingness to take on challenging and diverse characters made her stand out in a landscape that was often narrow for women of color in Hollywood. While Lathan had already made a name for herself in film, she proved she could dominate the small screen as well. Her role as the manipulative, power-hungry businesswoman in the hit drama series The Affair, 2014-15, was a testament to her ability to evolve with the changing tides of entertainment. The role garnered her critical acclaim. One of her most iconic TV roles came with Shots Fired, 2017, a miniseries that explored race relations and police shootings in America. Lathan played a passionate investigator, working to uncover the truth behind a controversial case, navigating the complexities of the criminal justice system and systemic racism. The series was both timely and impactful, allowing Lathan to showcase her acting prowess in a socially relevant and powerful way. The success did not stop there. She went on to earn her first Emmy nomination in 2022 for her guest role on Succession. Lathan also lent her voice to the character of Donna Tubbs on both Family Guy and The Cleveland Show on Fox, as well as to Catwoman in the DC animated series Harley Quinn. Lathan later reprised her beloved role from The Best Man for the film's spin-off TV series, The Best Man, The Final Chapters, in 2022. Lathan made a name for herself on Broadway, too. On Broadway, Lathan earned a Tony nomination for her captivating performance in A Raisin in the Sun on Broadway in 2004. She also starred as Maggie the Cat alongside James Earl Jones in the Olivier Award-winning revival of Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, 2010, at London's Novello Theatre in the West End. The film also made an appearance off-Broadway in 2012's By the Way, Meet Vera Stark. Since then, Lathan has expanded her reach. The star ventured into directing, making her debut with a short film, Leap, from Maven Pictures. Shot during the lockdown, the film explores the story of a Zoom therapist struggling with OCD and panic disorder, according to IMDb. Leap premiered at the prestigious Tribeca Film Festival. She continued sharpening her directorial lenses with 2022's On the Come Up, based on Angie Thomas's best-selling novel. It featured Lathan as the mother of a talented teen rapper trying to make it in a cutthroat industry. The film was lauded for its raw portrayal of ambition, youth, resilience, once again proving Lathan's ability to elevate every character she plays. During an interview with Global Grind that year, Lathan said that while she knew many of the technical aspects required for the filmmaking process, there were so many things she learned on the go about the post-production part of the business. It was really an all-consuming couple of years job, the Hollywood star said flat out. It really isn't for the heart of the faint. But Lathan lived up to the challenge and delivered. From a young, ambitious actress with a dream to one of Hollywood's most celebrated stars, Lathan's journey is a powerful reminder that the sky is the limit when talent, passion, and persistence meet. We can't wait to see where the next chapter of her incredible career takes her. This article was titled, Sanaa Lathan, A Journey Through the Actress's Career Over the Years, written by Shannon Dawson, News 1, August 5th, 2025. The next article is titled, Jackie Aina Has Always Been a Forver Mood, F-O-R-V-R. Here's how she became a business owner, too. Written by Victor Quinnell Vaughns, Jr., V-A-U-G-H-N-S. Ebony, August 4th, 2025. Jackie Aina is that girl, known for her YouTube channel and massive following. The beauty influencer turned entrepreneur has always been an advocate for inclusivity in the beauty industry. Her popularity grew through her makeup tutorials, honest product reviews, and beauty tips, all delivered with a dose of sharp wit and deep knowledge, especially for girls with deeper skin tone. She actively promotes diversity and representation, calling out brands with narrow shade ranges and pushing the beauty industry to do better. She's teamed up with top brands on successful makeup collaborations. But when it came time to launch something of her own, Jackie zagged when we thought she'd zig. Instead of launching a beauty line first, she introduced Forver Mood, F-O-R-V-R, a luxe candle brand that brings self-care, storytelling, and scent together in a way that only Jackie could. But Jackie Aino's influence goes far beyond contour and candles. She's long schooled the girls on fragrance, able to identify a base note from a YSL perfume that dropped 3 years ago, like it's second nature. From layering tips to scent memory deep dives, she's always been a scent savant. So it wasn't a shock when she expanded Forevermude beyond candles and into perfume, officially turning her brand into a full-fledged fragrance destination. Her latest perfume launch proves she's just getting started. Launched with her fiancé Dennis, whom we occasionally see making cameos on her social feeds, Forevermude is a vibe, a mood, and a movement. From homes to handbags, she's making sure we smell good wherever we go. For Black Business Month, Ebony sat down with Jackie to learn how Forevermude came to life and what she's learned on her journey as a founder fragrance. Ebony, we all know you as Jackie Aino, the beauty guru, and we know you don't work jobs, you are a job. Shout out to the City Girls. Where did your desire to become a business owner come from? Jackie Aino. Influencers and creators are business owners because of what we do. In the beginning, I was my own lawyer, editor, and videographer. I went over my own contracts, etc. So naturally, as my journey as a self-employed creator began to grow, my business and the people I hired grew too. I think creating a product felt like the next best natural transition, because I knew exactly what I wanted to create and how I wanted to occupy and innovate that space. It's very, very different from being in front of the lens, but I absolutely love how being a founder has allowed me to grow and evolve as well. You know your scents almost as well as Jacques Cavalier does. How do you decide on your scents? When choosing a fragrance, I factor in my mood, what I'm wearing, where I'm going, if I'm going anywhere, because fragrance at home is a must too. The weather, the time of day, how I want to be perceived, etc. All those things that go through my head as I go through my fragrance collection daily. What are some of the things you've learned as a new business owner that initially threw you for a loop? Every day, expect something chaotic to happen, and there's no guidebook or blueprint for being a founder, only gems and lessons learned from others, but everyone's path is totally different. I've had the must have been the wind candle burning after work for a few weeks now. What are some of your favorite wind down scents? In the evening, I love cuffing season. It's romantic and truly a classic. For all of us single folks out there, how does it feel to work with your soulmate? It's the best decision we've made together. When you work with someone you love, you have to know your role and respect their role. We do that quite well, and it also simplifies making big decisions together. Where do you see the brand in 10 years? You're all about self-care. Will there be a chain of Forevermude spas? I'm honestly excited and ready for wherever the fragrance industry needs innovating. One thing I've learned is what may seem like the plan in 1 year is out the window the next. This article was titled, Jackie Aino has always been a Forevermude. Here's how she became a business owner too. By Victor Quinnell Vaughns Jr., Ebony, August 4th, 2025. Next, an article from The Root titled August 2025 Books by Black Authors We Can't Wait to Read, written by Angela Johnson, The Root, August 8, 2025. It's hard to believe that summer 2025 is almost in the books, especially when most parts of the country are still experiencing record-breaking heat. But while you may have already started your back-to-school shopping, there are still plenty of great reads hitting the shelves in August. Just in case you want to squeeze in one last beach trip, from romance to fantasy to memoir, we've rounded up some books by the Black authors we can't wait to read in August. Cootie, the memoir by Kid Cootie. Day and Night, artist Kid Cudi is out with his debut memoir, Cudi, this month. He writes about his journey from childhood to growing up in Cleveland to music stardom, and how he dealt with depression, addiction, and a near-fatal overdose along the way. People Like Us by Jason Mott, M-O-T-T. People Like Us is the latest novel from Jason Mott, author of Hell of a Book. The story alternates between two black writers who are trying to find peace in a world filled with gun violence. A New Me by Helen Oyeyemi, O-Y-E-Y-E-M-I. A New Me is a novel that centers around Kinga, a woman who has a different persona for every day of the week. But when one of these personalities finds a man tied up in her apartment, the Kingas are forced to try to figure out which one of them may not have the best intentions. Once Upon a Time in Dollywood by Ashley Jordan. At the center of Ashley Jordan's novel, Once Upon a Time in Dollywood, is Eve Ambroise, an up-and-coming playwright whose personal life has seen better days. In attempt to reset, she leaves everything behind and heads to the Tennessee mountains until she finds herself falling for the single dad next door. The black family who built America, The McKissicks, Two Centuries of Daring Pioneers by Cheryl McKissick, Daniel and Nick Childs. The Black Family Who Built America is the story of McKissick and McKissick, the black family-owned construction company behind some of the country's landmarks, including the National Civil Rights Museum in Tennessee, the Barclays Center Arena in Brooklyn, New York, and the Philadelphia Eagles' Lincoln Financial Field. This book makes clear that the McKissick family should be mentioned in the same conversation with those prestigious last names so often heralded as models for what we call the American dream. The Cruel Dawn by Rachel Howzell, H-O-W-Z-E-L-L. In times like these, we could all use a little fantasy. Enter The Cruel Dawn, a romance which centers around Kavaira Megidrail, K-A-I-V-A-R-A, M-E-G-I-D-R-A-I-L, a warrior who must decide if she can trust an ex. The Rewrite by Lizzie Damilola Blackburn, D-A-M-I-L-O-L-A. The Rewrite tells the story of Timmy, a black writer trying to navigate the literacy scene in London. Things take a turn when she gets an opportunity to ghostwrite a celebrity memoir. The only problem is the subject is her ex-boyfriend who dumped her right before going on a popular dating reality show. Mounted on Horses, Blackness and Liberation by Bitter Kali, B-I-T-T-E-R-K-A-L-L-I. Bitter Kali draws on their experience as former urban equestrian, black queer person, and child of Jamaican and Filipino immigrants in Mounted, a collection of essays about the vital role horses have played within the black community. Family Spirit by Diane McKinney Whetstone, W-H-E-T-S-T-O-N-E. Family Spirit is a novel about Ayana, A-Y-A-N-A, a young woman who comes from a family of clairvoyants. While dealing with the pressures of being a college senior, she's also trying to make sense of the gift she's inherited and the secrets her family has held on to decades. This Kind of Trouble by Tochi Eze, T-O-C-H-I-E-Z-E. This Kind of Trouble tells the story of Margaret and Benjamin, a couple who found love in Lagos in the 1960s, despite the warnings of Margaret's family. Although their relationship didn't last, the couple has reunited to try and erase a family curse and save their grandson. Black Moses, A Saga of Ambition and the Fight for Black State by Caleb Gale. In Black Moses, Caleb Gale writes about Edward McCabe, a black businessman who lobbied politicians to create a state for black people to live among themselves. Full of Myself, Black Womanhood and the Journey to Self-Possession by Austin Channing Brown. In Full of Myself, author Austin Channing Brown writes about her personal experience with what she describes as activism-induced burnout and provides a roadmap for other black women on how to live their best lives during these trying times. Beyond Midnight by Ian K. Smith. Beyond Midnight is the fifth installment in Ian K. Smith's Ash Kane mystery series, the mysterious death of undocumented immigrant Jaquin Escobar is ruled an accident until his nephew, who thinks something suspicious went down, hires Ash Kane to find out the truth. The Dancing Face by Mike Phelps. In The Dancing Face, a professor plans to steal the priceless Benin mask from a British museum in order to liberate it, but others with more power and fewer morals want to get their hands on the mask as well, leading the professor and those he cares about down a dangerous path. The Independent calls the book brutal, deep, cunning, and unbearably beautiful. Positive Obsession: The Lives and Times of Octavia E. Butler by Susan M. Morris. Octavia Butler was a pioneer in the world of science fiction, writing blazing trails for future generations of black storytellers. In Positive Obsession, Susanna M. Morris writes about how Butler's positive obsession with the craft of writing inspired her to create, despite tremendous obstacles, including rejection and personal hardship. This article was titled August 2025 Books by Black Authors We Can't Wait to Read, written by Angela Johnson. The Root, August 8, 2025. That's all the time we have for the African American Hour. My name is Rosemarie Onwuah. Thanks for joining me.